Welcome to Still Untitled. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
This is the Adam Savage Project.
Yes.
We are here, another new angle, another new location. We're at your home office.
We're in my home office. If you can they see the model on the wall?
I think they saw it last time.
Yes. Oh, okay.
Sure. Yeah, when we had the wide shot on the of us on the couch.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm back. Everybody's here. It seems like
this is the first
regular podcast. I mean, I guess there's been no gap.
No, there hasn't been a gap for them, but there has been some spotty gaps for us.
We backlogged some. How's everybody doing?
I'm doing pretty good. The holidays were incredibly nice and quiet for me.
That's not usual for you, because like the last time you had a break from the show, you went on this whirlwind tour of North America, it seemed like.
Yeah, and so the Christmas break was, in the end, 3 weeks of real quiet, followed by two first weeks of January of real quiet. So it's been quite gentle. Sketchfest is here in the city right now.
Wonderful. And you're kind of its honorary mascot.
Well, I end up doing a lot of stuff because I'm local. And Janet Varney and Cole Stratton, who are two people that started it, are friends of mine. And I do as much as I can for them. I interviewed Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein on stage. We did Woodstock here, and that'll go up on the site soon. What else did I do? I did riff tracks at the Castro, we threw the opening night party of Sketchfest at the Man Cave.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Which was very...
The riff tracks, I didn't see the performance.
Yeah.
Do you come up with your own bits for that?
You can, but they've already done all the really heavy lifting. So those guys are so smart.
Yeah.
They've become really good friends of mine over the years. They're so smart and so funny. And they show up, they send you the video a couple weeks before. Then they send you a sample script. And, you never actually get to looking at it. You look at a little bit of it enough to sort of feel panicky.
Yeah.
And then you show up on the night and you feel really panicky. Everybody does. I was like talking, Kevin McDonald from Kids in the Hall was sitting next to me. And he's like, is this really that easy to do? and it's like, no, it's totally cool. I guess last time I did one about kids building ridiculous things out of cardboard, and this kid built a truck that pulled up to a bank all out of cardboard. And I made a joke about the truck pulling up at the Edward R. Murrow building in Oklahoma City, because it really looked like a Unabomber kind of kid.
Oh my goodness.
Perfectly appropriate.
Perfectly appropriate for children's films. This time they found a dry cleaning propaganda film called More Dangerous Than Dynamite, about doing your own dry cleaning with gasoline, which is so weird. We've got to try it on the show. Like, is that something you could do?
Well,
use gasoline to clean your
dry
clothes?
Dry cleaning stuff isn't that far off.
And this is old,
gasoline. It's all super flammable.
I had no idea.
To be clear, it's all old black and white 50s archive.
It's like Prelinger archive.
Yeah. So
stuff,
what these
right?
guys do is they find old archived films of instructional films, educational films and stuff, and then they put their own narration on it, or they comment upon the narration itself.
We should do this also.
Have you ever gone down the Prelinger hole before?
I have gone down the Prelinger hole a couple of times.
I mean, I guess we should. Prelinger is it's this guy who collected tons of footage. It's all sorts of stuff. It's like educational film strips. There's a lot of ads. There's 40s stag films.
To be honest, actually, the Riff Tracks guys, they also buy their own on eBay, and they buy hundreds maybe 10 or 15 good ones. It's a very low percentage.
There is a lot of really bad film, but I mean, there's stuff like, the story of the atomic bomb, the duck and cover, where duck and cover originated.
All from films like that. Yes.
Right. The story of Rubba.
Yes.
It's great. If you've never watched The Story of Rubber, I think it is actually called The Story of Rubber, and it tells the story of how rubber trees became a multi-billion dollar industry.
It's like how
in
it's made, but pure and
marketing.
Honest.
No, it's marketing. It was made by the marketing departments before they had marketing departments.
Well, so I did riff tracks with the MST3K guys at the Castro, and that's the third year I've done it. I've also done it with them in other locations, although they escape me right now. I have so many friends and friend acquaintances that come through town over Sketchfest. It gets quite busy, and then it gets quiet again. And I have yet, we've finished 1 month of the year, and I have not yet gotten on a plane.
Wow.
That is anomalous in the last couple of years. I flew 140,000 miles last year, so it's quite nice to, I am flying in 2 weeks.
Put your feet on the ground for a while.
To put my feet on the ground for a while, yeah.
It's not bad.
How's it been for you, baby man?
I left the house twice in the last, I think we took the baby out twice so far, two doctor's appointments, two leavings of the house.
Did you get any judgmental questions from strangers?
Only about the picture I posted. About, you mean just in general,
about
or?
The baby or about the beard or about?
I found when I had babies, yeah. that people were just couldn't wait to be judgmental. Oh, what a cute baby! Where's his hat? Things like that.
Yeah. Well, most of our visits have literally been like we haven't gone out yet because she's not yet back to her birth weight, which is the thing that you're supposed to do before you expose them to the public in flu season and
course,
all that.
Of course.
But we've had a lot of family in, so we've had a lot of quality family time and way too many people in the house pretty much all the time, which is exactly the thing you're not supposed to do.
Right.
But I mean, I have it kind of easy because Gina's breastfeeding the baby. So that means that like, I just keep Gina alive and change diapers.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's the one who has to get up and feed every 2 hours.
Keep the baby alive.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's her thing. So like I have the easy end of this deal for sure.
When my boys were born, which was 99, and I lived over on 23rd between Mission and Valencia. Mm-hmm. And there's a Walgreens right there on 23rd and Mission. And I'd go there all the time for the diapers. You know, that was the emergency diapers.
Yeah.
You'd get them cheaper over at the
You
get them cheaper over at the Safeway. But the thing is back in 99, it seemed like everybody had children. There was like a glut. And you could never find the Huggies in the size you specifically needed when you needed them.
I'm going to go on Amazon.
Yeah, that was,
Before they did diapers,
Before you do subscription, diapers.
So, the diaper thing is I've made a lot of late night trips to Target and like I found the 24-hour Walgreens now, I'm good on that. I've been cooking a lot. The nice thing about this is I get to cook a lot more than I normally
do. That's awesome.
Which has been a lot of fun. We have a lot of breakfast for dinner.
Yeah.
And that's very popular right now.
Breakfast for dinner has been one of my favorite things ever since I was emancipated.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's like I can have pancakes
fancy breakfast, or do you mean like a big bowl of cereal?
No. I'm talking pancakes.
Okay. Yeah. Or well, waffles. I do biscuits and gravy and sausage and eggs and
bacon. Yeah. Eggs are good anytime.
Yeah. Scramble.
I remember at one point, you know, when you have young children, there's just a million ways it can be exhausting. Like I remember for at least 2 years, you know, there's always a chance that they'd throw up in the car, which was just, wow, that
awesome
boy that, you know, and it was like, we used to joke like clean clothes make them nauseous. You put on something nice, like a suit, they vomit all over it. Or you forget the nappy one time in the car and that's when they spit up. Or they haven't spit up in 6 months, but they do the once time you forget the nappy.
The only time she throws up is when you don't have the wiping cloth.
So I remember at one point just making this decision in my head because I had to, like at 5 a.m. when it's that time of the feeding and we realize that we have one diaper left. I love going to Safeway.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it. I had to assume that role of I'm loving this and that's how I do this.
At least you can walk.
You brainwash yourself.
Exactly.
Like so my move is I'm sitting there, I'm like, if I put a wallet into these pants, are they gonna fall down? And then I go pile in the car and drive to Target in my plaid flannel pajamas. Like there's a lot of poop.
Oh God!
But it's not bad poop yet. One of our friends brought their kid over to meet the baby a few weeks ago.
It's got real bad.
And poop. I saw like a 7-month-old poop. Oh, and that is some terrifying.
Yeah, it goes up the back.
It is. Yeah. It was full total coverage. And so, like, we went through the whole environmental diapers to like the super Huggies with the triple baffles.
You just
the
technology is your friend in this department.
And that's pretty much it. I mean, I've been doing a lot of cooking. So, breakfast food. I want to ask about breakfast food.
Oh, okay.
Food. If you're making breakfast food, the go-to?
Yeah.
Pancakes, eggs, bacon,
sausage? No. For me, it's an omelet.
Omelet, okay.
Omelets and scrambled eggs. Those are the...
Because eggs are your specialty.
Eggs are my specialty. So, I can do the over-easy. I can do the fried eggs. I
do a poached?
The zooty canoody. I do great poached eggs
as well. Do you do the spinning water or do you do the skillet?
I'm very adept at the spinning water.
Oh. I'd like to learn the spinning water. So I do the skillet now, which is the poor man's spinning water.
I don't know the skillet.
You put about 2.5 inches of water in a nonstick skillet and then you just cup the eggs down into there and they sit just tiny amount sticks to the bottom and it holds them in place.
Oh, interesting.
No, so you don't get the cool swirly patterns.
Yeah,
but.
And the swirly pattern is really difficult. You can only kind of truthfully do one egg at a time that way, so it's laborious. But I prefer the Gordon Ramsay scramble.
Yeah, the 30-minute slow scramble.
It's about 10 minutes. Okay. I do it in a frying pan. I've got it down to as good a I feel like darn near as good as in a saucepan, in a thick bottom saucepan, and I do it in a nonstick frying pan, because when you do that slow scramble, those eggs can be the hardest things to clean out of a pan ever.
You just get rid of the pan, put acid in there.
Yeah, and then the omelet. I've perfected the omelet over the last couple of years.
What do you put inside?
What's your favorite omelet?
My go-to omelet. We should do a thing where I cook. I should cook this on camera. But I'll tell you, it is. I do a two or maybe sometimes a three egg omelet. I like a really light omelet. Mm-hmm. I don't like the big heavy folded pillow that they give you in a lot of places. So I do like a two or three egg omelet. Onto that, I do usually a jack cheese or sometimes a Havarti, something kind of like that.
A little good pungent,
gummy but pungent. Pepper jack also
Gruyere
great.
Is great.
Gruyere, absolutely. And then I put avocado in. Now, I used to slice my avocado and put it in chunks. I've actually discovered that if you put it in scalloped spoon scoops, where it's like really thin at the edges, the avocado becomes a much better texture inside the omelet, and it marries with the eggs much better. Then a little cayenne, a little salt, a little pepper. I fold it over. I then put a little swash of buffalo chipotle sauce, which is available at any of the Mexican places here in the Mission for 99 cents a bottle. And it is like sriracha sauce for us. It's a lifeblood sauce that we'll put on almost everything.
I like the sound of this.
And then I put some more avocados on top of it. And I served it for a friend of mine who's a sommelier one morning. And he goes, I got to tell you, it's two things I don't like. One is eggs and one is hot avocados. But you freaking nailed it.
Norm, breakfast?
Breakfast? I don't eat breakfast. Oh, for dinner? No, I don't like breakfast for dinner that much. I'll eat the waffle or bacon. But, bacon.
So if I'm in a diner though, and it's time to have breakfast for dinner, it's waffles.
Yeah. Really? Like, see, I go for greasy eggs then.
Fat waffle,
Like a big over easy. Yeah. You know, with
grilled cheese sandwich, which is also kind of breakfasty to me.
The grilled cheese sandwich and the tomato soup. I made a big batch of tomato soup a couple weeks ago and froze some, and we've been busting that out.
So they have a macaroni and cheese grilled cheese sandwich at Bender's Bar here in the Mission. This is honestly one of the
greatest. That sounds like about a 3,000 calorie sandwich.
It is. I don't care. You know, it's just unbelievable. I think I'm going to go there for dinner tonight.
Sounds pretty good. I
think you convince yourself.
I do. The thing I found is if you take mushrooms and you chop them up incredibly fine, till the pieces are literally, you know, a couple of millimeters across, five millimeters across, and then saute that with a little bit of butter or olive oil or whatever until the liquid reduces. And then chuck that in almost like a paste on the omelet or in the scramble. It kind of turns them black almost, which is a little bit of a weird look, but it tastes phenomenal. Real mushroomy.
So we've been doing mushrooms for a few years now, in a Thomas Keller preparation where you take your different types of mushrooms, and it works with a whole bunch. You know, you can try oysters and chanterelles and other ones, where you slice them thin, like eighth of an inch thick, and you saute them in a pan with butter, shallots, and salt.
It's always good.
And you do them in groups of the same kind of mushrooms, so you get them to the same consistency. And he's got a recipe where you just then pour those mushrooms over a straight, like, parpadelle.
Really?
And I swear, I never thought I would love, like, have a deep, abiding relationship with a pasta that wasn't covered in sauce.
Yeah.
But this is one of our go-to family dishes.
Well, the thing is, the mushrooms, when you can concentrate that mushroom flavor, it makes everything better.
The fresher the mushrooms, the better. Like, you got to go over to Brian's to get the real, or I mean, luckily we have Byright. To get really the first time we
Gold Star mushrooms.
Yeah,
over there,
the first time we cooked it was my friend Carl came over with some mushrooms that had been picked in Marin that day, like a shopping bag full, and we made dinner for like 10 people.
Well, I mean, whether you put them under pizza or on the omelet or a scramble or whatever, it's always good.
You give up meat for this. Like, they're so delicious.
Well, they taste meaty and wonderful. Especially, I love the oyster mushrooms. So
we weren't going to talk about
sorry. I'm a little hungry.
Went straight into Portlandia territory.
We did.
Mushroom have to roam?
What was your mushroom's name originally? Was this Brian or Steve?
Mushroom's name was Colin, and he was glad to give his life for my benefit.
We were going to talk about design influences 15 or 16 minutes ago. So Real quick now.
No, we'll take time.
Do we have a time limit? No, we can stretch it out.
Yeah, what the hell?
It's the internet. There's no time limit. At 23 minutes, there's an ad. God damn it. And we can say all sorts of, we can say whatever we want. Yes. Yeah.
Design influences. So, yeah, you know, it's an interesting question because I started out, actually, one of my first jobs as an adult was working as a graphic designer in New York. Mm-hmm. And this is in 87, 88. Before computers were regularly used as graphic design tools.
So when you, at this point, when you were doing graphic design, you were probably making something that was a mock and then shooting it on film and then using that to enlarge or whatever, right?
So allow me to explain some of the process of doing graphic design in 1987. You would, let's say, be doing an annual report. Your client, AT&T, we did AT&T's annual report one year, the small design firm I worked for. AT&T would give you all the copy that would go into that report. Then someone needed to count how many words and characters were in that copy. That's called type specking.
Yeah.
That was something, that was the first job I had.
That is oh my goodness.
So you'd have to figure out exactly how many, given the font you were going to use, how many column inches you were going to need to fill this entire annual report. Once you had that, then you would have that type ordered in that font, in that line width, justified or unjustified, et cetera. You'd give all these specs to somebody who worked a thing called, I believe, a Sertronics printer, which would actually assemble this. It had hundreds of fonts and then print it on photo paper. Once you had that photo paper, then you hand cut the type out and you laid it out according to your blue lines on a piece of mat board. If there were photos, you did Xeroxes of them, or you actually, and the other thing I did was I operated a stat camera in a shop for a couple of years. You blew them up or reduced them using a photostat camera, which is photo paper in a dark room, mixing and everything. And then you'd bring those out and cut them to size. And you'd always write on top in red ink, FPO, for position only, so that you'd hand a master photo reference to your printer who would then put it in. All this done by hand, all this with like blue lines and crop marks done with ink and pens. It was incredibly, incredibly laborious. But there is no greater training to being able to see whether something is laid out correctly than when you're doing it all by hand like that.
Well, even if you're using a desktop publishing package, Once you, the trick is going from, hey, I'm looking at this thing, to, hey, this is what it's going to look like in the final product, and taking away all the extra stuff is what I always found.
And also what you see on the screen, the size and everything is completely different.
Especially in the old days when monitors were tiny.
Paper and color and everything.
I mean, I find myself when I'm doing design on the computer, I zoom out a lot, I zoom back in, I print it out, I see how it feels, I make notes on my prints, and then I go back into the computer to rework it. But there's
design influences.
So you have to, so when you do graphic design like that, when I did graphic design like that, that's how it had been done. Excuse me. That's how it had been done for decades.
Yeah, since the 50s, probably.
And so the people that I was paying attention to when I was getting into graphic design were people who are still huge influences for me, which is the Saul Bass, the whole New York school from the 40s, 50s, and 60s, Ivan Chermayoff and Geismar, the pushpin style of Seymour Schwast and Milton Glaser, all of those guys were so brilliant. And especially, I was just telling my cameraman about this because he's really good at drawing fonts. He doesn't know that he is, but he didn't know that he was.
Don't encourage him to design fonts. That is a path toward ruin and destruction.
The thing is that when he lays out a lot of the signs for our experiments in tape, his sense of line weight is impeccable. And I was telling him that, like, when I was first learning about doing design, someone sat me down and showed me how to draw out some fonts and line weights of, like, serif and sans serif and just play around with it. And there's a great education in understanding how brilliant people like Herb Lubalin were with their logo types and how they would do this stuff by hand to figure out this thing, which is so takes so much artistry.
Well, when you look at a logo and you see that they did the thing, and the only thing that changes with the default font in the logo is that there's a little tail on the W where there wouldn't normally be a serif.
Right.
It looks like anybody could do that, but it turns out that getting that and getting the circle right and all that, it's really hard to do and make it cohesive and look good and smart and clean. And actually, the trick is how well stuff ages with a lot of that.
Yeah.
And if you look at some of the stuff from the late 50s, early 60s, I think a lot of those designs have aged much better than any of the stuff that came after and that replaced those designs.
Well, and it's also because we you know, we've spent the last 20 years. I mean, remember when desktop publishing first became really big, which is like
Quark Express.
91, yeah. 92, the first Quark Express. And then Mondo 2000 came out, and that was like how to use every font on every page in every color possible.
Well, but the tools always affect how design, I mean, the tools that are available just, always affect stuff.
It took a while for people to learn how to sit back and tackle the problem of does it all work on the page.
And it's happening right now with video.
Is happening right now with video. So my big influences are like that. And you guys at home can't see the rest of our house, my house, but my wife's and mine, big influence is mid-century modern, as evidenced by the John Draper couch you guys are sitting on.
There's a lot of Mad Men here.
Yes, and we love the clean lines of that. Now, I have a friend who is very, very almost sternly attached to that aesthetic to the degree that he doesn't mind a piece of furniture that's not comfortable as long as it's beautiful.
Oh, no.
We go for both. We love both.
This is very clearly a lived-in home.
Yeah, and I mean, this couch is made by an American company named Viosky down in Los Angeles. This is the Chicago. We bought it from my friend Deanna at Inside Modern here in the city. We have a teddy bear chair, you know, the classic teddy bear chair, which is one of the most comfortable chairs ever in the world to sit on. We love that design aesthetic.
With all the Ames stuff.
Milo
bent curved wood and all that, yeah.
Absolutely. You know, the other thing is I love local design, right? I'm a locavore as well. So the coffee table here is designed by a local designer whose name I really should have looked up before we did this podcast. When we do a video about the shelves here, I'll tell you the designer.
The shelves in
the
back, I think, are my favorite thing in this room, and that's really saying something.
They're really beautiful. Yeah. They're really gorgeous. And again, the local designer made to order, just like absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous aesthetic, really clean. So it's also quite a different aesthetic in my house than in my shop. Mm. And that is also by design. Like, so I like being overwhelmed when I'm working.
Do you shop online, or do you have, you know, instead of walking around town? Or
both. My wife does a lot of searching on First Dibs, which is a great place to look for what's coming into town. A lot of designers and interior designers are looking at the same items. Oftentimes you can see something you're interested in and get it for a better deal than you might just through straight retail. Because, you know, there are some retailers who sell the stuff we like at a reasonable cost and some who sell it at a ridiculously exorbitant cost.
Have you been able to shop HD Buttercup down?
No.
It's a massive, like, three-story store that's all full of this furniture.
That's probably, my wife has almost definitely been there. I have not. And, you know, I also am very influenced by early comic book artists like Jack Kirby.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that in that.
Some of the pop art.
Yeah, absolutely.
Color palettes, maybe.
And also, absolutely, it's the people that I grew up with being fascinated by as artists: Magritte, Joseph Campbell. Mm-hmm. No, not Joseph Campbell.
Joseph Campbell wrote. Oh, that's Joseph Heller.
Campbell. Oh my God, I can't believe I can't remember. The guy who did the little boxes. It is Joseph Campbell, isn't it?
I'll fact check. Keep
Hold
talking.
On. Fact check me while we're talking here. Sorry, Marcel Duchamp, perhaps my favorite artist of the 20th century. Marcel Duchamp is the Some
of your art, your early art, kind of has a little bit of you can tell that Duchamp, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, some of my art, the found stuff has a lot of Duchamp influence. But I'd say the thing that would classify my early art more than anything else is steampunk, although I was doing that in 91, 92. We'll have said this here before.
Yeah.
But I love Duchamp because he was not only commenting on art, he was not only commenting on the form and the formality of art, he was commenting on art itself and the culture of art. Which he didn't necessarily always have a tremendous amount of respect for. And I think that's deserved. Not many people know. We know cubism is something that Picasso and Braque sort of birthed in the early part of the century in Paris. And yet not many people realize that the first splash that cubism made in the United States is actually Duchamp's painting, Nude Descending a Staircase, which by calling it Nude Descending a Staircase, he's actually, in a way, thumbing his nose at the cubists. Giving it such a classicist title was actually So it arrived in New York at the Armory Show, the famous Armory Show, mm-hmm. I think in 1914, if my memory is correct. And it made this terrible splash and people were all up in arms about this new art form. It was terrible. Everyone was very upset about it. But at the same time, the Cubists were also upset about Duchamp sort of calling it nude descending a staircase. You know,
he was a troll.
He was a troll. And so when you talk about Andy Warhol or someone like Jeff Koons or mm-hmm. someone like Damien Hirst, commenting on the state of art at the same time as contributing to it. Duchamp is the proto. He's the prototype for that. And I revere him. Calder. Calder is also a huge early influence for me. So for me, when I think about design, it falls under all of these guys' rubric, from the graphic guys of Herbert Ballin and the New York School all the way to, you know, mid-20th century and early 20th century art.
Fantastic.
Wow. We got to cover that topic. Yeah.
Omelets. Omelets and design.
Omelets. We should do a video of cooking an omelet.
Your kitchen's ready to cook in. We can put a camera on one side. It's good to go.
Absolutely.
We'll come back to that.
Okay.
As always, thank you so much, Adam. If you have questions, the email address is podcast@tested.com. Put the subject line questions for Adam. We will do another question show at some point in the indeterminate future. And as always, reviews, ratings, all that stuff on iTunes helps a ton. You guys have been instrumental in making us successful on iTunes.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much. Like us on YouTube, whatever it is, you know, or if you, and feedback. We always appreciate feedback, whether it's positive, negative. If you hate us or love us, it's all good.
Yeah. If we have verbal tics, though, that you don't want to hear anymore, don't let us know or be gentle about it.
Yeah. We don't care about that stuff.
So someone once years ago was like, Adam says actually too much on the show.
Actually, that
and
person is
that
a
was
pedantic.
Actually, ever since I heard that, actually, I think, every time I say the word actually, yeah, I think about
it's
that
okay
fucking
to
guy.
Be self-conscious about that. You're changing yourself a little bit.
It is. But that's why I don't read any other comments. Well,
don't Google yourself.
I can't be self-conscious about everybody's thoughts about what doesn't work.
The other day I was going to post a pedantic comment on the internet, and then I decided that it was already taken care of, so I just moved on and did something constructive.
You know, someone just reposted that classic XKCD comic of, honey, are you coming to bed? I'll be there in a minute. Someone's wrong on the internet.
Bat signal. See you guys next week.
Bye.